Welcome to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Hi, I'm Carol Bissett, a crime writer, and I invite you with my co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson, each week to our conversations on all things murderous. Hello and welcome again. It's Carol Bissett here with my two co-hosts, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson. Welcome both.
Welcome, Carol. Hello, Carol.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about psychological thrillers today, but I thought beforehand we're going to see where each of us are with our own work, because let's not lie, we want to promote our work as well. It's not the reason we do the podcast, but it's...
Oh, yes, it is.
Seamless, Carol. Absolutely seamless.
Oh, Liz, I mean, you're busy at the moment with your series with Paula, aren't you? Is that done?
No. We have not long ago finished writing the draft of book five. So we're at the point now of reading through it and then doing the edit before it goes to beta readers. So we're in the publishing process, which will take some time because it's out at the end of May. And in the meantime, I am also writing book three in my ghost suspense series.
Yay!
So Nora Rides Again.
Oh, fantastic.
So yeah, it's about to get to the bit where they think they've got it right and it all goes horribly wrong.
Oh, we like that.
Yeah, I like that bit. So
it gets
yeah,
a bit complicated.
That's where I'm at. But I've also been talking new series with Paula, so watch this space.
Oh, exciting. Yeah, and Paula is going to be a guest speaker when we can get it arranged, who writes with Liz. Looking forward to talking to her and getting her views on things. And Mike, how's your novella coming along?
Sorry.
Oh, that was low.
For those of you that may be listening to this for the first time, if you go back to episode one, I think it was, you'll know that I was bullied into promising to write a novella.
No, you of your own free will, Mike.
No. I was bullied into... suggesting that I should write a novella because my history has always been to write short stories. So writing a novella of something like 40,000 words...
so much.
Yeah, scares the living daylights out of me. But you'll be pleased to know that I have done a little bit of... I was going to say research, that would be the wrong thing. I've done a little bit of plotting. Now, that is alien to me as well. I've got a title, which is The Lost Cafe...
Ooh.
And the very loose theme is that this cafe is found by this main character, whose name I think is going to be Adam, quite by accident. He's wandering around the streets late at night. He's a writer. His muse has deserted him. And he's just wandering around his local city. And he comes across this cafe. And he's surprised because he's been down this road many times, never seen it before. So he goes in and it turns out that this cafe is not an ordinary cafe. And the toilets, when he goes to the toilets, to the loos, they're actually portals to other worlds.
I thought you were going to say they're clean or they have loo rolls or something like that.
No, they are portals to other dimensions.
How? When you flush?
A good question. That I haven't yet got an answer to.
I am agog. So, I can't wait to hear more about this.
Do you do something like that in the Harry Potter movie where they go to the Ministry of Science? Ministry of Magic?
Magic.
I'm thinking of that scene in Trainspotting where he goes down the loo.
You see, there is never, ever a brand new idea.
Sorry, Mike.
No, you're right. Because I think every idea that any writer has, there is a smidge of something that they've read or heard about. Somewhere else. So anyway, that's where the novel's at. So ask me again in about 6 or 7 episodes and we may have decided how the portal loos work.
Oh, so bad. I'm imagining a villain now wielding a toilet brush.
Yeah. And the other thing that I'm doing is I've actually started collecting another series of 100-word stories. I've got a book out published which is called Exactly 100 Words, which was 100-word stories. And I'm partway through collecting another set of 100-word stories. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to actually self-publish that certainly within the next maybe 3 weeks, oh, 4 weeks.
Wow, okay.
Did you notice, listeners, the surprise on my my two friends' voices when they said, that close?
When the Mike's boots come out, they're very good. It's just that the process sometimes is a little bit longer than, you know. Anyway, no, I've actually just completed the first draft of my fourth Warrington Detective book. Which I'm fairly happy with. I'm pleased with the way it's gone. And I have got a sort of a tiny idea for the next book. This one is called For I Have Sinned, and that's all I'm telling you about it. But the gang get together again to try and solve some hideous murders and also some kidnapping and a bit of torture.
Fairly standard for Carol.
Yeah, yes. A bit of light reading.
Just dead nice in person.
And I have been toying with trying a lighter detective book. I forgot the name of my character, Cowslip Brown.
Oh.
But that's about all I've got at the moment. I think if your parents call her Cowslip, you need to grow up tough. That's what I'm saying.
She's probably, he or she, Cowslip.
Yeah. She.
Mm. She's probably related to a young lady that served me in Marks and Spencer's this morning, whose name badge read Meadow.
Oh, right. Okay.
A different name.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes. Although I have, I've taught a miracle.
Oh, right.
And also an ocean. Both very smart girls. Yeah. Okay. There you go.
I taught a pagan once.
Oh. But... how did that go?
Another story.
Any burnings at the stake, I want to know. Mind you, pagan is a religion and they go with nature and the seasons. So I'm sorry, I'm not disrespecting anybody's... the way anybody believes, that's something that happens. It's a thing.
If anybody's interested in some of the things that we talk about and want to know a little bit more, for example, Carol's latest books or Liz's latest books, or even my progress in the novella.
And the toilet brush.
I plan to put some blog posts up where we'll give hints of some of the stuff that we're doing. For example, I'm going to put a blog post up within the next week or two, which may have one or two of the stories, the short stories, that are going to be in my next 100 words book. So if you want to have a look over the blog post, there should be a link to it in the show notes.
Yeah.
We'll be putting extra stuff on there, so please go and have a read.
And if you want to ask for anything in particular, then please do, because it gives us an idea of what you'd like to know more about.
Yes, you are our audience, and we would like you to. Yeah.
Well, somebody recently on our YouTube channel put a comment about wanting to know more about how we got our ideas, where we got our ideas from. So that's going to be a future podcast episode. We're going to talk about prompts and where we get our ideas from.
Yeah.
So we are always happy to hear what you want us to do.
Yeah, because sometimes our ideas come from something that's quite amusing. You know, it's amazing where writers get their ideas from. So, folks, to today's topic, which is psychological thrillers. Not a great fan, because I'm a bit of a scurdy pants, and I'm just wondering where the line is drawn between it being a psychological thriller and horror. That's my what is a psychological thriller? Have you got any thoughts on this?
I'm not a great reader of psychological thrillers, so it's going to be a good podcast. But for that same reason as Carol, that I'm easily scared. I'm a big scaredy pants. But to me, psychological thrillers are books that actually get inside your head in a not very pleasant way and play around with your head. And I think that's the bit that scares me sometimes, because sometimes once something's got inside your head, it's difficult to get it back out again.
Yes.
It tends to live with you.
You couldn't get more different from our previous podcast, talking about Agatha Christie in a world where you know everything will be back to normal at the end.
Yes, reassuring, yeah. Mm. I mean, I've Googled this. Themes include death, Why are we here? Existence, purpose, your identity, the mind, which is what Mike's just said, your perception of things, reality, and it's all defined as a mystery, drama, action, and paranoia. You know, and that is very often when you see a psychological thriller, it's you know, delving into the brain to make people really unsure of what's actually going on. And when
I imagine things like gaslighting part of that as well.
Have you got any writers that you particularly like?
Having to think about this, because I don't read that many, although I have edited a few. One I really enjoyed was Gone Girl. Have you read or seen?
I've read it and I've seen the film.
What did you think?
You really did mess me up.
And there you have it.
Which was what it was supposed to do, wasn't it? It was like, no, yes, no. You know, and the ending was a bit like, oh, like, but yeah, it did exactly what it said on the packet. It was a thriller that was psychological.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
But I think it's an interesting one in that I know people who say, oh, I hated that.
Yeah.
Well, I could not get on with it. I didn't finish it. I just couldn't, you know.
Mm.
And I think that's the thing with these books. I think they tend to be Marmite books where either you really like that and you really get into that. It's like people who say, oh, I only read books about serial killers. And I must admit, I think, why?
Why? Mm.
But there you go. We're all different. Mm. So
I'm trying to think of a book that I read which would fit into this genre.
Mm-hmm.
And for the life of me, I cannot remember the title. But the premise of the book is a young lady who has lost her ability to remember things. Mm-hmm. So every day, at the end of the day, she writes down what she did. Mm-hmm. So the first thing she does in the morning is pick up this book to remind her what she did the day before. Otherwise, mm-hmm. she has no memory of what happened before. And again, it's a great book, but mm-hmm. there's that psychological twist that comes into it when you really, I'm not trying to give anything away, not that it's much help because I can't think of what the title is, but the twist is that while you think, and everybody seems to imply, mm-hmm. that she's got some sort of memory illness,
mm-hmm.
There's something more untoward going on within the way that she's being treated
and there's a whole thing there about the unreliable narrator, isn't there? I mean, just because you write something down doesn't mean it's true. Mm,
yeah,
but could be how you choose to perceive it or how you want other people to think that you see it.
Yeah.
So
I wish I could remember the title. Mm. It will annoy me, that.
I'm going to say, I mean,
it's quite similar to Memento, that.
I'm sure it wasn't.
Thinking of?
I've not seen it as a film. I've only read the book.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of the same sort of. Yeah,
I think one of the themes were you know, put in that genre is when people don't know who they are or what's mm-hmm. happened to them in the past, mm-hmm. or people that have had their identity stolen, and have got like no past whatsoever. You know, sort of that type of thing. I mean, the person that springs to mind for me, and I have read a few of his books, I've definitely seen his films, is Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mike's got a few things to say about Stephen. I mean, I've read and I've watched Misery, and it did make me feel slightly ill in places. I've got to say, and another one that I found really difficult to watch but couldn't not watch was Silence of the Lambs. Which, you know, is really spooky.
I haven't read it, but really enjoyed the film.
Yeah.
But that says about me.
Yeah, no, but I was sort of looking at it like this, you know, sort of. And then somebody said the prequel to that, which I can't remember what it's called, is even scarier than what before.
Is it Red Dragon?
I think it is. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That is as well quite a scary film sort of thing. So,
yes.
That's
the thing, I suppose. It's like, I think you were saying this earlier, Mike, before we came on. Is there a dividing line between psychological thriller and horror? And if so, I mean, do we all put it in different places or what? Because I would probably class Stephen King more as horror, although I've read a few of them and really enjoyed them. And to be honest, they don't bother me that much because I kind of think, I don't think these things could happen to me, so I'm okay, which is a bit of a cavalier attitude, but...
Yeah.
Whereas there are other things I've read where I've found them really quite disturbing, and I wouldn't, I wouldn't read another, or I wouldn't finish that book. So
I think it's very easy to get a mindset. I've never liked horror films, so therefore don't watch horror films. Mm. And therefore I see Stephen King as a writer of horror books and haven't read any of his books. And yet I really think I should, because from what you've said, Liz, and what other people have said, he's a great writer and has written some great books.
Yeah.
So, sometimes it's a mindset you get. I don't like horror.
Mm. Like, it is, stop. Yeah. Because we, as a family, we have film night on a Friday night, and we can all say what we're not prepared to watch, and mine's horror.
Uh-huh.
I'm quite open-minded about most other things, but if they put something horrific on, I would just have to get up and walk out of the room. So I think we're all different. Mm-hmm. Would you ever consider writing anything that was in the horror genre? Well, yeah, I was going to say, yes, psychological thriller isn't necessarily horror. We're talking about the two things sort of overlapping a little bit, and I think they do in a lot of the books, don't they?
Yeah, I think elements of, yes. But I can't see myself actually writing a full-blown psychological thriller.
No.
So, I mean, I've definitely written characters who, try and gaslight other people, try and make them believe that things happened that didn't. I've written some nasty, sadistic people, and some people who, frankly, their version of reality is probably not the same as anybody else's. I think that's, if you're writing, straying into the darker side of crime, I think, that's fairly par for the course. How about you, Carol?
Well,
some of your books have got some dark moments.
Yes, they have. I was just going to read a little bit out.
Oh, go on.
This is just a page. This is the prologue, and it's not very long, but this is out of Searching for Evil, which was my first Warrington detective book.
Available from all good bookstores.
He stood back to admire his work. It was good. Not perfect, but good. He smiled and gently touched a hand. Would the investigating officers suspect that this was his first time, that he was a murder virgin? What did it matter? He was proving a point, and all he had to do now was get away with it. That would show those idiots who had scoffed at his brilliant ideas. The hands and feet had been tougher to remove than he thought. The face, though, had been easy. Now he just needed a place for the body to be found, and then he could sit back and watch the circus from a distance. This was going to be fun. Psychological thriller.
Well, I think it is, because quite often with a murder mystery story, it's somebody else who's talking about the victim. Mm. Somebody's found the victim, whereas you're coming at it from the point of view, from the voice of the person doing the murdering, the murderer.
But as it goes into the book, it's the detective. Every now and again, this person pops up and there's a little bit of mental thought process where they're at, going on.
But he's trying, in that little passage you read, he's trying to get inside our heads, which is what I think psychological thrillers do. They want to get inside your head and sort of mess around.
It's that weird kind of seeking for approval. Oh, they think it's my first time. I've been professional enough.
Yeah. I mean, and I... This sounds terrible, but
you worry
me
sometimes, Carol, frankly.
I study mass murderers, serial killers.
Now you worry me.
Yeah.
And it's the psychological side of it more than anything. And most of them are psychopaths, and they have no empathy whatsoever, which is why they do what they do, and they usually have a good reason for doing it, in their heads, obviously. I want to wipe the world free of all the prostitutes in the world and this sort of thing, and very scary. But I mean, some of them are like real life recordings of Son of Sam and things like that, and it does make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, because at the way they talk about it, they're the sort of people, I think, if you were interviewing them to write about them, you wouldn't sleep well at night. After you'd been to see them at all.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's that absolute unshakable certainty that what they're doing is the right thing and it's everyone else that's got it wrong.
Yeah, everybody else is out of step.
I think sometimes too is that when you read something like that or hear something like that, it takes us back to that idea that whereas the world is a fairly decent place in which to live, in which there's some good things happening, some bad things happening, every now and again you come across something that is pure evil.
Yeah.
And there's something quite unpleasant or unnerving about somebody who's so off the scale that they're sort of reaching that evil.
Yeah, so I mean, this was the title of the book, Searching for Evil, because the detectives who are looking for this murderer just feel that there's an evil presence, you know, that this isn't, well, most murders are committed by people that know the murderer. Is that right? Have I got that the right?
That's right, yes, yeah.
Well, they know the victim.
That's the one. Things like being snatched off the street and all this sort of thing are very, very rare. And when it happens, that's when, like the Yorkshire Ripper, things like that, that's when it really gets to us. When somebody disappears and then we get a chain of events that look like that this isn't the first time, and then it happens again and it happens again. And this is the fascination. I suppose it's like a morbid curiosity, really, about what's going on and what's going on in their mind, sort of thing.
I think sometimes, because it's so alien to the way that you think, that part of you is thinking, how could somebody do that? Or how could somebody even think about doing that? It's so, I say, so far removed from what you see as the norm that it's difficult to believe. And at the same time, it's scary to think that actually it could have happened.
Yeah. I mean, in Wire in the Blood, the psychologist there, he says quite a few times through the different books, he's that fine line between understanding a serial killer and being a serial killer. It's a very fine line, and he could have gone one way or the other, you know, because he can get into the mind of a serial killer, which helps the police in Val McDermott's book solve the case. But it worries him that he can see what they're thinking, and, you know, they're going to do this next, because he is so close to actually being on the other side of the fence and actually being a serial killer. So
and that scary feeling, I suppose, where you feel like you actually have to police yourself to make sure that you're still on the right side.
I think as a reader, the odd psychological thriller that I've read, I've probably persevered with them because I want evil to lose and good to win in the end.
How about the Stieg Larsson books?
Yes,
I think they come under psychological.
Now I've enjoyed those, but again, it's possibly because they fall into the category that evil doesn't, you know, good wins in the end. I think the odd book I've read where it's almost left unfinished, as though maybe evil did win in the end. They're the ones that worry me most, because it leaves in my head a feeling that everything's not quite right.
Yeah, it's like when they get the person at the end of the book, the film, the play or whatever, and then that person says something that makes you think, oh, it probably wasn't him after all. You know, you're going to see more of this, you know, the person following me is going to be worse. You know, but you do get that in some books where you've got to sort of make the ending up yourself. And it doesn't sit well with me. I don't know about you two. Do you like a proper end?
Oh, yes.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yes. I've got to have a proper end to a book. Otherwise I feel cheated in some way. I don't know how popular a genre it is. I'm guessing a very popular one in terms of,
I think so.
Readers
I mean, Where in the Blood is they're definitely psychological thrillers, and I love them. But then we're going into the area that I as I say, do a lot of research into the mind of the serial killer, the person that thinks they're going to get away with it and all this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I've got to say, with Val's books, I hardly ever guess who the killer is.
Yeah. See, I have to admit to, as I think I said right at the beginning, be a bit of a scaredy pants when it comes to anything like this. For example, I drive my wife around the bend because at night time I insist on closing the wardrobe doors. And she'll say, why? I said, well, if you don't, the bogey monster will come out and eat you during the night.
See, now, in my case, I close the wardrobe doors because the cat will get in and then cause a horrible mess.
I think my excuse is probably better because, you know, you've got that monster in there. Mm. My wife thinks I'm slightly, I'm not sure what the word is.
We'll ask her next time we see her.
Yes. Yeah. Going back to, going off on a slight tangent, going back to Stephen King. As I said, I've not read any of Stephen King, and maybe I should.
Mm, you should.
But what I have done is read his book called On Writing,
yes,
which is part of an autobiography, but also it's a great section in that about writing. About
I think you both said it was a good one.
It's a really, really good one.
I think I lent you mine. Yeah. You have given it back, so that's cool.
So if anybody out there is a budding writer or thinking about going down that road, it's certainly a book worth reading. He's got some great ideas, some very simple ideas about writing. And as somebody who's written some very successful books, he's worth listening to. So,
yeah, I think when he got the advance for Carrie, I think he said he slid down the wall when his agent said how much it was going to get. Because he really struggled, like most writers.
Oh, he struggled, yeah.
Financially and probably mentally, he struggled a lot because he was having to do other jobs, as most writers do, while he was writing. And as I say, he is a very successful man.
I think he had some health problems too. One sort of
I know he was hit by a car.
Yes, that comes out of it.
Carrie, wasn't that the book that his wife basically picked out of the bin and went, this is good, you should carry on with this.
Yes, because she used to be his, like, she was his barometer of what was good and what wasn't good.
I think she still is.
So that's...
I might actually take some quotes from that book and put it into a podcast. Ooh. Not into a podcast, sorry, into a blog.
Into a blog.
That goes with our podcast.
Good idea.
So there's another blog post for you to look out. And if you want to know where the blog is, have a look in the show notes. There'll be a link to it.
Mm. Do you have something to read there, Mike?
I do, actually.
He's brandishing some paper for those of you who can't see.
Yeah. I'm not sure if this falls under the psychological thriller, but I'll leave you to tell me. This is a story that I wrote some years ago. But I haven't published it as such. Poor Jessie, it's called. Winter seemed reluctant to release its hold, and I, for one, was extremely grateful. It meant the lake on the outskirts of the town would remain frozen a little longer. Then the first weak rays of the spring sun would start a gentle thaw, and she'd be found. I'd like to say I hadn't meant to kill young Jessie, but that would be a lie. I enjoyed every minute of it, revelled in her clawing and screaming, her begging me to let her live through those gasping sobs. Then there'd been that tremendous adrenaline rush as I'd worked out the best way to dispose of a body. It'd be my first time, but I knew it wouldn't be my last. I realise now how fortunate I'd been. You could call it beginner's luck. I'd been a little cavalier, not as thorough as I should have been. Dumping a body in the lake would not now be my first choice. Too unpredictable. No saying how quickly it's going to be found. But as I was saying, my first time and I was lucky. That night we had our worst storm of the winter and the next day everything was frozen solid. There was no way sweet Jessie was going to be found. Not straight away, at least. Like the other good folk of this town, I did my stint of searching for her. We looked everywhere. Everywhere, that was, except beneath those frozen waters. As you can imagine, there were plenty of rumours going around. Some said she had a secret boyfriend, a married man, no less. That frightened some of the men folk in town. There were lots of them used to watch Jessie stroll down the street and think thoughts married men ought not to think. A school friend said she wasn't like that, and there were no boyfriends, or at least none they knew about. They said she was more interested in her schoolwork than boys. When they interviewed me, I reiterated that sentiment. I told them what a delightfully hard-working and conscientious student Jessie Foster had been, and I should know, I was a teacher. I kept a few things. Not as mementos, I don't think that's going to be my style. Too dangerous. Locks of hair, pieces of jewellery, items of clothing, stuffed in a box under the floorboards, always have a chance of being found. And the last thing I want is to be caught. No, the things I kept are going to be used to help the police track down her murderer. It's someone I've had in mind for a while. In fact, he's one of the married men in town. Fits the bill nicely. Peter Jenkins. Runs the local hardware store. Nice enough guy, but not friend as such. I chose him because I happened to know his wife and son were out of town on the night in question, and he was home alone. Not the greatest of alibis. I made up one of those trinket boxes for him. Not a lot in it, just enough for the police to feel they've got their man. A St. Christopher necklace, a lock of her hair, some particularly gruesome photos of her naked body, and of course an item of clothing. I thought long and hard on this one. Underwear seemed a little bit too obvious. A blouse too big. So in the end I went for a scarf. You could still smell her perfume on it. I was round his house last week. He and Mrs. Jenkins were out celebrating a birthday or something. It was all too easy. I found a conveniently loose floorboard in his study, and while I was there, I signed him up for a few of those internet sites. You know the ones I mean. And just for good measure, put a few photos I had of Jesse walking around town on his hard drive. A few days from now, and the police are going to get an anonymous tip-off. They'll start by looking at his computer, and I'm sure it won't take them long to find the mementos. As for me, well, I'm happy to wait. Give people time to digest this news. Then I'm due for a move. New job, promotion maybe. New town, fresh start. And I can start looking for another Jesse. Psychological?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh. So why haven't you published that one?
I don't know. I don't know.
You should.
Maybe, yes.
Is it because it's too long?
Not really, no, because some of the short stories in my short stories book, which is available on KDP if you want to, on Amazon if you want to go and find it. It's called Don't Mention the Shed. Do you think that was a bit too...
No, that's not.
Nobody would have noticed. No, I've got some stories in there that are longer than that.
Right. Okay.
I don't know. Maybe it was because it was too psychological.
I suppose. If it doesn't fit with other stories you've written, it's that thing of... So I had this when I was putting together a short story collection. There were some stories which I thought, well, you know, it's fine as such, but it doesn't go with the other ones.
Yes.
And I ended up just thinking, no, I'll take that one out. So, yeah, it's a thing. But yeah,
Yes,
it did
make me a bit...
Yes, definitely. But yes, I think it might have been a bit mild after that, to be quite honest. But I've picked out a bit from my third Mrs. Hudson and Sherlock Holmes book. It's called Spider's Web, and part of the premise is bombs have been going off in London, and the bomber has been sending little notes to Sherlock Holmes. At this point in the narrative, Mrs. Hudson is about to head to Sherlock's funeral. This is not a spoiler. And a note comes. I was securing the second button of my glove when I heard footsteps hurrying upstairs. "I'm coming, Martha," I called. She burst in without knocking, her face white as a sheet. "It's a note, ma'am," she put it in my hand. "It's one of those notes." I looked down at the envelope. "To Mrs. Hudson," it said, in the stiff writing that Sherlock and I had come to dread. I ripped it open. "Dear Mrs. Hudson, I hope you don't mind me writing to you. Perhaps it's not the most convenient time, given your other commitments, but I would like to say a few words." "I don't believe this," I muttered. "It was a terrible shame about Mr. Holmes, but life must go on, mustn't it? And in the absence of the avowed star of the show, I'm sure that you, the understudy, will step up to the role. I've arranged a little surprise in memory of Mr. Holmes in a very public location. It will be most regrettable if you were to arrive late and cause any disappointment among the many people who will be there when the surprise is revealed. It's in a location you know well and where you have spent a great deal of time. Indeed, I myself have seen you there. As a special favour, I'm giving you extra time. We wouldn't want things to go off too early, would we? It'll be much better to wait until the venue is at its busiest, thronged with people. However, I must stipulate that you go alone and refrain from contacting either the police or your acquaintances. I am watching your house, the local telegraph offices and police stations, and any attempt by you or your servants to use them will force me to advance things. The very best of luck, Mrs. Hudson. Yours, an admirer. Oh, dear God, I murmured. It's him or her, isn't it? Said Martha. It's the bomber.
It just shows how a psychological thriller can come at you in different genres and different ways. Mm. You know, because, again, I think the thing there is a bit like the story I read and the excerpt that Carol read. Mm. It's all being spoken by the person who is doing the bad things.
Mm.
You know, they're letting you into their head, which is not a very nice place to be, while they're sort of telling you what they've done or what they plan to do.
And I think that's possibly the thing, in that with psychological thriller, you tend to get a lot more insight into the mind of the criminal, the killer, than you do in other genres, because
you have to, really, for it to be. What about the True Detective series? Is that a psychological thriller? Have you seen any of it? No. It was recommended to me by a colleague, and I've just watched the most recent one, and I probably would put it in that genre. So much so did I enjoy it that I've gone right back to the very first series, and I'm watching them. But yes, there's an awful lot of thought processes going on, and you are sort of a bit on edge, wondering what's going to happen. So, I would put that under, especially this last one where there's frozen bodies popping up all over the place. Mm. Yeah.
I'm possibly thinking about it, a bit of an Agatha Christie anomaly here. The ABC murders.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Where you get those little snippets and you think, oh,
they're
gosh.
They're clues, aren't they?
Yeah, and it's like, oh, is that who? Is that the person? And you're absolutely a god for the next one.
That sounds I wouldn't have thought of that, but it does sound like
it was interesting when they did the fairly recent adaptation about, of course, they felt the need to like beef it up as they do and include all sorts of interesting content that was not in the original.
Yeah, they do that.
But again, going back to our three readings, isn't it strange that in each case, the perpetrator whose voice you heard was very confident? In each case, they were confident about what they were going to do. They had no moral qualms about that.
Mm.
And they came across as being confident that they would do it again.
Yeah.
And that this was not a one-off and they wouldn't get caught.
Yeah. I mean, in the case of the person who was writing the letter in mine, they've already got away with it several times. Yeah. So, you know, they may be entitled to be fairly confident.
Yeah,
but yes, in both of your cases, you know, that's someone who's comparatively new to what they're doing.
They think they're doing pretty well.
And I mean, your protagonist, Mike, you know, is very conscious of, well, if I do that, that could be dangerous.
Yes.
So, I'm going to avoid that. And
And he's learning from his mistakes.
Which is always dangerous. And the other thing that they often see is that serial killers have they do things in a certain order, and they have very similar gaps between murders.
Mm.
And when they start getting more, it's very worrying. When they start accelerating their crimes, that's very, that's worrying. And if there's a big gap, it's very often because they've been in prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've gone to prison for something else, so they've not been able to. So it's all about laying the information out in the right order, isn't it?
It's going back, isn't it? I mean, last episode we talked about Agatha Christie and about Poirot, and it's the idea that in another writer's mind, the very clever Poirot could have been a villain, could have been a murderer. But then I think the problem with that would be if he was as clever as Hercule Poirot, but he was Hercule Poirot as a murderer, then he wouldn't get caught. And then I think readers
That would be the difficulty, wouldn't it?
Because readers want an ending, don't they? They want a happy ending most of the time.
Yes. I'm not going to mention the thing I would love to mention, but I won't.
It's a bit like Sherlock Holmes, though. Sorry, very, very quickly, but a bit like Sherlock Holmes. Moriarty is Holmes's equal.
He's his nemesis.
But he doesn't get that many mentions.
Well, no, he's hardly ever there really. I mean, he's always portrayed as, you know, the great villain. But
you don't
see him
about
three times.
Yeah.
which is partly why I decided to give him a bit of a run out in Mrs. Hudson and Sherlock Holmes.
We like villains as long as they get their comeuppance.
That's Well, I think most people do like villains who get their comeuppance. Yeah. This is why James Bond is so popular and so because he always wins.
He does. So I think we've come to the end of this episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. Like us, share, press that bell, and all those sorts of things. But just listen, and that's the main thing. And we'll be with you again next week. And just in the meanwhile, that noise you heard, was it a cat crying or was it somebody screaming? You have been listening to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production, produced by John Bissett. The music, In Peril, was composed and recorded by OM Studio Strings.